speak about a few subtopics from the beginning of the Sedra in the Parsha Bikurim that all have connection and shed some light on Yomim Noroyim in preparation for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur also. The mitzvah of Bikurim is part of a group of mitzvahs that all have basically the same underlying idea. And that is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to dedicate the first to Him. We find first fruits, Bikurim, firstborn, Pidyon HaBen, and by animals, right, Bechoros, the first shearings of the wool, Reishis HaGez, the first of the dough, Reishis HaRisoseichem, first of the dough, give to the Kohen, give to God. The Tzad HaShoveh, right, the common thread that connects them all is that God wants us to dedicate the firsts to Him, usually by giving it to the Kohen or redeeming it from the Kohen or so on. Now, I am a firstborn, so I have no trouble believing that the first is the best. So God wanted the best. I assume many of you are not firstborn, right? How many of you are not firstborn? You probably don't agree with me. And you're right, in certain cases. My case, not the case. But in other cases, it's possible the first is not the best. So why does God want the first? Why doesn't He say, you know, take a few samples, first, second, third, and bring me the best? Why the first? There are other answers. But one idea is the following. The first is not only the first. It forms the foundation and root of everything that comes after it. It sets the pattern. And in a building, if there's a hairline crack in the foundation, the whole building is in danger of falling down. Whereas if that same crack would be on the third floor, it wouldn't be any problem. So the foundation has to be as perfect as possible to hold up the whole building. If there is a small blemish in the root, it's going to come out in the plant 1,000 times. But that same blemish on a leaf is not going to make any difference. So it's very important that the root and the foundation be as perfect as possible. So God said, take the first, which form the foundation and the root for everything that comes after, and dedicate it to me. Kodesh Kadoshim, and then it'll set the pattern that at least if you take the first fruits and dedicate them to me and bring them to the Beis HaMikdash and give them to the Kohen, then the second, third, fourth, at least you'll eat it with a bracha. At least you'll understand where it comes from. Because you've set the pattern, you've created the foundation and the root in the most perfect way. Give you two examples where we see this idea that how important the foundation and the root is, that how much it has to be as perfect as possible. First of all, it says that the world exists on the breath, the babble of little school children. Tinoko Shobes Rabba. The Maral says because they are Reishis HaTorah, that's the foundation of Torah. When you're dealing with the foundation, that is the most pure. That has to be the most pure. One example where we see that when you set the foundation for something, it has to be as pure and perfect as possible, is the following Gemara. The Gemara says in Bava Metzia, I think it's on Pei Vav. The Gemara says that Reb Chiya said that if the Torah would ever be forgotten, he has a program how to revive and cause the rebirth of Torah. He would plant flax and harvest it and make rope out of it, make the rope into nets. With the nets he would catch deer. The deer he would shech, give the flesh to poor people, And on the hides of the deer, he would write Chamisha Chumshei Torah. He would make parchment and write Chamisha Chumshei Torah. He would go from city to city and teach five young school children, each one a different Chumash. Six school children, each one a different Seder of the Mishnah. And then he would tell each one to teach the others what he learned. And that's way he would ensure the revival of Torah. So they ask, I understand if it's a time when the Torah is forgotten, you can't walk into a bookstore and buy a chumash. Nobody's selling chumashim. But don't they sell nets? Don't they sell parchment? Why does he have to plant the flax, make the ropes, make the nets, catch the deer, make the parchments? All superfluous. Go buy parchment. They say the answer is that since we're talking about the rebirth of Torah, we're talking about setting up the foundation, the reishis, the new beginning. Even the nets that catch the deer on whose skin you're writing the Chamusha Chumshei Torah has to be totally L'Shem Shamayim. Because in the foundation, in the root, everything has to be L'Shem Shamayim. The opposite is also true. When it's not, when it's blemished, it causes horrendous damage later on. More than it would cause had it not been at the foundation and the root level. Where do we find that? Acher. Elisha ben Avuya, right, was known as Acher, right, went off the derech in a big way. Tana, mentioned in Pirkei Avos, mentioned in the Gemara, went off the derech completely. So our Gemara says, what happened to him? What caused him to go off the derech? So our Gemara in Kedushin says a few different episodes, amongst them the following. He once saw a father tell his son to climb up a ladder and bring him some bird's eggs from a nest that was on the roof. And the son dutifully obeyed his father, went up to the bird's nest, sent away the mother and was mekayim the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein, took the eggs, and on his way down, fell off the ladder and got killed. Now the Torah promises long life for both of these mitzvahs. And here's a guy in the midst of doing two mitzvahs that the Torah promises long life, gets killed. So he said, I can't believe anymore. There's no justice. There's no judge. Everything is, it's all a lie. And he went off the derech. The Yerushalmi, another thing the Gemara says, is he saw the tongue of Chutzpis HaMeturgeman being dragged by a pig in the dust. Chutzpis HaMeturgeman was the person who conveyed the shiurim of the gedolim to the masses. Not every gadol could speak in a way that he could bring his voice out that everybody could hear. They didn't have microphones, so they had special meturgamanim, people who understood the shiur and could give it over in a more charismatic and louder way to the rabbi. That's called a meturgaman. So Chutzpis was one of the meturgamanim par excellence. He was killed by the Romans. They didn't let his body be buried, and a pig came and took his tongue out and dragged it around. He said, I can't believe anymore. This tongue conveyed so much Torah, projected so much Torah, and it's being dragged around by a pig? There can't be any justice in this world. There can't be a God. I don't believe. That's what our Gemara says. The Yerushalmi, which Tosus brings down in Chagiga, says that Acher problem happened way before that. It happened the day of his bris. The day of his bris, his father Avuya was one of the most influential and rich people in Yerushalayim. So he invited to the Suda all the rich people and all of the Talmidei Chachamim. So the rich people were eating, drinking, dancing, enjoying the Simcha. So the Talmidei Chachamim said, you know, if they're enjoying it their way, let's enjoy it our way. So they started to learn. And they were discussing Chumash and then Nach and then Mishnayos, Torah Shebaal Peh, and they were learning with such zeal and intensity that a fire came down from the heavens and surrounded them. So Avuya came over to them. He said, "What are you doing? Trying to burn down my house? What's going on over here? No fire's lighting over here. Forget it. You know what? What are you doing?" He said, "No, this is not a real fire. This is a spiritual fire. We were learning Torah with such intensity, we brought down the fire of Har Sinai around us." He said, "Hey, wow. I mean, people who learn Torah can bring fire from the heavens? I want my kid to learn Torah. So one day he'll be able to bring fire from the heavens. And since his entire foundation and root was distorted, you don't learn Torah to bring fire from the heavens. That's not what Torah is all about. Therefore, he went off the derech. He could have changed his root and foundation, right? But he chose to continue what his father dedicated him to. And there's no contradiction. Because his root was crooked, everything he saw was crooked. So when he saw these two maishim of the kid climbing the ladder and the tongue of chutzpah, he came to the conclusion that there's no justice. Because his whole orientation was, he wants to bring fire from the heavens. He wants Torah to be in this world. But Rabbi Yaakov, his nephew, saw the same maishim with the child falling off the ladder. And he came to a different conclusion. That schar mitzvah b'hayal malecha, that there's no reward for mitzvahs in this world. When the Torah promises long life, it means eternal life in the next world. Why didn't Acher come up with that conclusion? Because his whole orientation was crooked, because his foundation and his root were crooked. So you see that if you want to create a foundation, a root has to be as perfect as possible. If it's not, then what's going to come from it is going to be blemished and crooked and very detrimental. And that is the idea of the ratios. The first. Take all the firsts that form the foundation and the root and dedicate them as perfectly as possible to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so then everything that will come after that and be built on that will be as perfect as possible. Based on that, I want to explain to you a halacha that you probably learned or are going to learn soon in the halachas of Asher Shemei Tshuva. One of the halachas of Aser Shemei Tshuva is that even a person who is lenient in certain areas where you're allowed to be lenient, but it's a leniency during the year, during Aser Shemei Tshuva should not be lenient. He should be machmer. The example that the Shulchan Aruch gives is paspalter. What's paspalter? The halacha is that if your neighbor, a goy, bakes you cookies or bread, and the ingredients are all kosher, he uses new pots and pans, cooks it, bakes it in a totally kosher oven, comes to your house, uses your ingredients, your pots and pans, your oven, so you know it's kosher. You can't eat it. That's called pasakum. Bread baked by a non-Jew, just like wine touched by a non-Jew, food cooked by a non-Jew, with certain parameters, is also to eat. Could be 100% kosher ingredients, but it's not kosher because the goy baked it. That is a private goy. But, the rabbi said, and this only applies to baking, if the goy is a commercial baker, he's not your private neighbor. He's a commercial baker. He does it for profit. Then, the halacha is, that's called paspalter, bread of a baker, not bread of an individual. And then the halacha is, l'chatilu, you shouldn't eat that bread. You should eat bread baked by a Jew. But if the bread is of superior quality, you can't find something baked by a Jew of the same quality, or it's cheaper, then you're allowed to eat that bread, that paspalter. It's not mahadrin, but it's kosher. That's the halacha. Shulchan Aruch says, even a person who is lenient to eat paspalter a whole year during Aser Shemei Tshuva, he should. He should be machmer and only eat Pas Yisrael during Aser Shemei Tshuva. An example, what's Pas Palter? Entenmann's cakes. Heard of Entenmann's cakes? They have a hechsher, OU. They're kosher. There's a mashgiach who makes sure that all the ingredients are kosher. But they're baked by Goyim. But it's a commercial baker. Therefore, since the quality is, according to some people, better than the Jewish baked cookies that you can get, and could be it's cheaper, I don't know, right? So therefore you're allowed to eat it. But during Aser Shemei Tshuva, stay away from Entenmann's cakes. That's the Shulchan Aruch. Now I would understand this halacha if it's talking about somebody who says, you know what, last year I was lenient, it was okay, but it's not, you know, the highest level, and this year I'm going to try to be on a higher level. So I'm going to try it out during Aseres Metzuva and not eat Entenmann's cakes and see if I can do it or not. And if I can do it, I'll do it the whole year. That would make sense. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about a person who does not intend to stop eating Entenmann's cakes the whole year. He has an order in to break his fast Motzei Yom Kippur on Entenmann's cakes. No shaila. Except during Aseres Metzuva, when we're being judged, lay off on the Entenmann's cakes. Whoa, we're trying to fool God? Hey, God, you know, I'm really frum. I don't eat Entenmann's cakes. So you better give me a good judgment. And then, Motzei Yom Kippur comes and says, fooled you. I eat Entenmann's cakes. I was just, you know, trying to make a little good impression during Aseres Metzuva. What's going on? What's the purpose of stopping something for Aseres Metzuva that you know you're going to continue afterwards? The answer is, one of the answers is, and we have the same question with other things too. People during Elul, Aseres Metzuva, daven with extra kavana, extra long, give extra tzedakah, learn with extra fervor, that they know they're not going to do a whole year. Who are we trying to fool? Putting on an act? Oh, it's Elul. There's an Elul God that demands this. The rest of the year is a different God. He demands other things. What? It sounds very fake. But it's not. If somebody would tell you, look, I'm going to build my house, and really I would love to use grade A cement in the whole house, but I can't afford it. It's like twice as expensive as grade B cement. So I'm going to use grade B cement in most of the house, but the foundation I'm going to use grade A cement. Is he a hypocrite? Faker? No, does it make sense? Yeah. Same thing here. I can't be grade A the whole year. But Rosh Hashanah till Yom Kippur is Reishis Hashanah. It's the foundation and root of the year. So like we said, if the foundation and root has to be even more perfect than the rest of the building, because the whole building and the whole plan emanate from it. Therefore, if you do things in a better way during Aseres Metzuva, even if you know you can't do them the rest of the year, at least you've created a foundation and a root that's more perfect. So it's not hypocritical. It makes a lot of sense if you understand what these 10 days are vis-a-vis the rest of the year. Okay, so that is the first point, the concept of Bikurim coming from the Reishis. Next point. Torah says, V'hoya kisavo el ha'aretz. It'll be when you'll come into the land, fulfill the mitzvah of Bikurim. Says the Medrash, Asei mitzvah zu. Do, fulfill, observe this mitzvah of Bikurim. And in its merit, you will inherit the land. So it's very nice that by fulfilling the mitzvah of Bikurim, you are going to get the merit to inherit the land. It's only one problem. The mitzvah of Bikurim didn't start until 14 years after we were in Eretz Israel. We already conquered the land and settled it. 7 years of conquering, 7 years of settling. Then, any new fruit that you had that grew on the tree, from that point on, you had to bring his Bikurim. Anything before that, there's no mitzvah Bikurim. So they didn't fulfill the mitzvah Bikurim until 14 years after they entered Eretz Israel. How could that be the mitzvah that gave them the merit to inherit Eretz Israel? It didn't take effect until after they already inherited. How could that be the schus? So I think an answer could be the following. There's a famous Shari Tshuva. Shari Tshuva asks a question on a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. It says in Pirkei Avos, Kol shemaisa merubi mechachmaso, chachmaso miskayemes. Whoever has more deeds than his knowledge, his deeds are greater than his knowledge, then his knowledge will persevere. But if he has more knowledge than deeds, he doesn't do as much as he knows, then his knowledge won't persevere. I understand how it's possible not to do everything you know. But how is it possible to do more than you know? If you don't know it, how can you do it? Says the Rabbeinu Yonah, there's a medrash that says the following. Vayelchu vayasu b'nei Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu commanded the Jewish people the mitzvah of Korban Pesach on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. They didn't actually do anything till the 14th of Nisan when they shechted Korban Pesach. Yet the Torah says immediately after they left Moshe Rabbeinu on Rosh Chodesh, Vayelchu vayasu b'nei Yisrael. They went and they did it. What did they do? They didn't do anything for 2 weeks. Says the Medrash, Elakivan shekiblu al atzmam. Since they accepted upon themselves they committed themselves to go and make Korban Pesach when the time will come, the Torah considered it as if they did it immediately. The commitment, the acceptance to do it, is considered like you did it already. The Me'iri says even more than that. The Me'iri says that if a person commits himself to do tshuva, even if he hasn't done anything yet, he has a long path to do, and he has a lot of things that he has to do in order to fulfill the mitzvah of tshuva. But he's committed to that program, then as soon as he makes the commitment, he's called a chassid. He could have been a rasha before. He's a thief. He's a murderer, right? He's done terrible aveiras. He's going to have to return the lost article. He's going to have to say vidui. He's going to have charota and kabbalah. All the conditions of tshuva. He didn't do any of them yet. But he's committed himself to do it. As soon as he commits himself, he changes his status. It's not a rush anymore. It's a chassid. It's a tzaddik. With that, they answer a question they ask on a Mishnah in Kedushin. The Mishnah says if a man marries a woman on condition that he's a tzaddik gomer, the Kedushin should only take effect if I'm a tzaddik gomer. And we know him to be a rasha gomer. The Kedushin is a doubtful Kedushin. It could be it's good. Shema hear a tshuva believable. Maybe he thought about doing tshuva in his heart. So everybody asked, the Mr. Slinich asked, what does it help to think about doing tshuva in your heart? First of all, you need vidui to do tshuva. It has to be verbalized. We didn't hear him say anything. We know before he was Mekadosh this woman, he's a rasha gomer. We didn't hear him say anything except Harem Kudeshesli Amenash Hamitzadi gomer. So he never said vidui. If he's a rasha gomer, he must have stole things from people. You can't do tshuva until you return the stolen articles. So we know he didn't return the stolen articles between the time that he was Mekadosh this woman, between the time that he made this Kedushin. So how could he possibly be a tzaddik gomer based on this Me'iri? Because even if you didn't do anything yet, but once you committed yourself in your heart to do it, it's like you did it. You're already a chassid. Now you have to go and do it. But it already changes your status. So since it changes your status, you could be a tzaddik gomer. You didn't yet fix up all the averas. You didn't go through the process, but you change your status just with the commitment. So, and he says that that's the meaning of another pasuk in this week's Sedra. Pasuk we have in the Torah is Or Asher Lo Yakim Es Divrei HaTorah Hazos. Cursed is the person who does not. The way he learns Yakim means to commit himself to the Torah. The curse is not on people who don't observe the Torah, but a person who doesn't commit himself to observing the whole Torah. And there's a special bracha. The antithesis of that, the opposite, is Baruch Ha'ish Asher Yaseh Asher Yakim Es Divrei HaTorah Hazos. Blessed is the person who commits himself to keeping the Torah. The commitment itself is extremely important. And therefore, he says, it's possible to do more than you know. If a person says, look, I don't know too much about Yiddishkeit. I don't know what the mitzvahs are. I don't know what the halachas are, but I am willing to commit myself that whatever I will learn, whatever the Chachamim will teach me, I will accept and do. Then from the moment that you made that commitment, it's as if you did everything that eventually you're going to learn about. So you don't know too much, but it's like you did more than you know. That's Nasa V'Nishma. So it's possible to get rewarded already, to be considered as if you did it just from the commitment. Maybe that's what the Medrash means. Asei mitzvah zu doesn't mean actually fulfill the mitzvah, because you're not going to fulfill the mitzvah until 14 years after you settled Eretz Yisrael. But if before you begin to conquer and settle Eretz Yisrael, you commit yourself that 14 years from now, when you'll have first fruits, you'll bring them to the Beis HaMikdash and thank God, then you are considered as if you did it now, and in that merit, you'll conquer Eretz Yisrael, even though you never did the mitzvah. But you committed yourself to doing it 14 years from now, that is also a merit. And therefore, there's a lot of things that a person can't work on except takes a whole year to work on them. Sometimes years. But if you commit yourself on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur to start that program, and you're serious about it, right, then the commitment itself changes your status. And you're no longer in one status, you're a different status. In a different status, you get a much better judgment than the status you were before. And that just comes from the commitment not from the actual working out the whole program, but being committed to the program. You have to mean it, though. It has to be a strong commitment. Part of a strong commitment means that you also accept upon yourself strategies that will preserve that commitment. For instance, let's say a guy used to eat trade. Okay, every day he would go to work and he would pass Luigi's Italian restaurant, not kosher. Okay, and the aroma coming out of that restaurant just like, you know, mesmerized him. Like in the comics, you know, the whiff of the thing floating, just he knows when he went flying into the restaurant. And every day he ate, you know, tray for things in that Luigi's restaurant. He decides, now I'm going to do tshuva. Okay? I accept upon myself that I'm never going to eat in Luigi's again. Okay? And I haven't yet regretted and done fiddly or whatever, but I'm committed now, whatever the tshuva entails, I'm going to do it. And I'm not going to do this again. I commit myself to it. Yeah, but is your commitment really strong if every day again you're going to pass by Luigi's and be tempted by the aroma? So therefore, part of knowing if your commitment is strong or not is, along with that commitment, are you willing to accept safeguards that will make you observe your commitment? For instance, from now on, I don't walk in front of Luigi's restaurant on my way to work. I walk two blocks out of the way and walk behind the restaurant, backwards, back of it, a roundabout detour, in order that I shouldn't pass by there and be tempted to go in. So now my commitment has teeth. It's not just a commitment. It's a commitment where I thought out, how am I going to protect and enhance that the commitment should be able to be kept. So that's also part of the commitment. I mean it, I'm serious about it, and I have strategies how to ensure that I will keep my commitment. Okay. So that is the second idea. Third idea. What is the basis of the mitzvah of Bikurim? Hakoras HaTov. In fact, it says that's why the mitzvah Bikurim comes immediately after the parsha of Amalek. Because Amalekim were kfuye tova. They were ungrateful people. And therefore, the mitzvah Bikurim is, don't be ungrateful. Be grateful. Have hakaras hatov. Have gratitude. Bring your first fruits to God and thank Him for the crop that He gave you with the first fruits. Now, I can think of a lot of things to say about Amalek, a lot worse than they're ungrateful. Right? It's like saying, well, Hitler was ungrateful. I mean, he may be ungrateful, but he was a tyrant way beyond that. So why pick out by Amalek that they were ungrateful? That's the worst thing they were. And Chazal say, kol hakofer b'tovaso shoboso v'dov, somebody who's ungrateful to human beings, eventually is going to deny God. So emuna and gratitude go together. What's the connection? And basically, gratitude is the foundation of emunah. How so? You can't see God. How do you know to believe in God? You can't see Him. God is the ultimate good, but you can't relate to Him directly. How do you relate to Him? Through His deeds. You see the good He does in the world, for you specifically. So hakaras hatov doesn't mean gratitude. Hakaras HaTov literally means recognizing good. First, you have to recognize there's good in the world. If I recognize the tangible, visible good, I can then realize that there's a source for all that good, who is the ultimate source of all good, which is God. But I can't see God, so I need to see Him through His deeds. By recognizing good in the world, I will recognize the source of good. That's the bracha we make, HaTov, the HaMeitiv. God is good, and He does good. And by recognizing the does good, you come to recognize the good. You come to recognize that God is there. Right? That God is a contraction of good. He's the ultimate good. So in order to really have gratitude, okay, you need 3 points. And that's why Kfuye Tova doesn't mean ungrateful. Kfuye Tova means you cover over the good. You don't recognize it. Gratitude starts by recognizing that there's good. And that entails the following. Most of us have the philosophy that I am entitled, especially in this generation, and everything's coming to me. Magiali. Right? It's coming to me. I once saw a political poster in Ranana, picture of a person running for mayor of a city, and it said, vote for so-and-so, magialecha, it's coming to you. Now, I don't know if that was for him or against him or whatever, but in other words, like, you deserve this guy, okay? You deserve him, okay? So vote for him, because you deserve him, okay? We basically go through life feeling like that. In other words, we have this feeling that when we were born, we had a guarantee attached, I guess, to our big toe that said the following. You are guaranteed 100% satisfaction in this world, or you have a right to complain. And most of us function like that. And therefore, if something is 95% good, but 5% is missing, we complain about it. Right? If a woman prepares a meal, right, and your mother, your wife, and it's a delicious meal, but missing a little salt, too much pepper, whatever. So what do we usually do? We don't speak about the great meal, but there was a little salt or whatever. We complain about the salt that was missing, the pepper was missing. We complain about the 5% that's missing and don't recognize the fact that the 95% that was there, right, is nothing. You have to have a shkafa, which the Medrash says, what can a person complain if he's alive? Nobody promised you more than life. If you're living and you have nothing else, so be happy with your life. If you have anything more plus, be happy for that. But don't have the philosophy that I am entitled to 100% satisfaction, and if I only get 95%, I complain about the 5% I'm missing. Have the philosophy, I'm deserving of nothing. If I have 5%, be happy for that. If I have more than that, be even happy. Don't complain about what you don't have. Be happy with what you do have. That's part of a sameach b'chelko. Be happy with the share that you have, not what you're looking, what you don't have. So the first component of hakaras hatov is literally recognizing good, not taking it for granted and thinking that I deserve it. It's coming to me. It's not good. It's just what's expected. Recognize that nothing should be expected, and whatever you have, the most smallest thing is good. And you have to recognize that. That's the first thing. In order to do that, you have to really recognize even small good, because if you're only going to recognize big good, nothing will ever be big enough. So you have to recognize the smallest good. One of the places we see that is the Yontif of Tu B'Av. It says, Lo hayu yamim tovim l'Yisrael, kichamishoser ba'avak yom ha'kippurim. So Gemara said, I understand Yom Kippur is a big yontif because you get your sins forgiven and the Torah was given then, second luchos. But what's so special about Tu B'Av? So Gemara says, because that day the people who were killed in Beitar were able to be buried. And two miracles happened. They were able to bury them and their bodies hadn't decomposed. What happened? When the last stronghold of Bar Kokhba, when they thought that maybe Bar Kokhba Mashiach was in Beitar, and the Romans decimated them, completely killed everybody, men, women, children, and left the bodies exposed to the elements for 3 years. They didn't let them get buried. Finally, 3 years later, on Tu B'Av, this happened on Tisha B'Av, about 70 years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. 3 years later, on Tu B'Av, they were able to get to the bodies and bury them, and they saw the bodies didn't decompose. So they made a big yontif. Girls go out and get engaged on that day. And they made a special bracha in benching that we say all the time, Hatov HaMeitiv. Hatov, God is good, that he permitted them to be buried, and he does good that he didn't let the bodies decompose. Now, I don't know, but maybe I'm missing something. That doesn't sound like a real reason to rejoice. These people were still dead. Right? So their bodies didn't decompose, and they were to be buried. Very nice. But they still were dead. This was the nail in the coffin of Golus. Bar Kokhba, supposed to be Mashiach, was killed there. 3 years, they didn't let him bury the bodies. All of a sudden, make a yontif. Hey, wow, you know, something real great happened today. We were able to bury, you know, a bunch of men, women, and children that were killed by the Romans, and their bodies didn't decompose. So let's go out and celebrate. I would have made a fast day and said, you know what, but since there's some good over here, the bodies didn't decompose, and they're able to bury, you could stop fasting 5 minutes early. That's what I would have done. Not make a yontif. The Chazal wanted to teach us a lesson. A long Golus was starting then, which we're still in the middle of. And during Golus, there's a lot, there's very little good to be happy about. A lot of tzoras. So if you're looking for the complete satisfaction, you're going to be miserable during Golus. So Chazal wanted to teach us that if something is 95% bad, but there's 5% good, celebrate the 5% good. Don't look at the 95% that's bad. Here there was 95% bad, but 5% was good. Celebrate the good. That's the attitude you have to have. And even the smallest good, you have to celebrate. That's why by Bikurim, it says they made a whole fanfare. You know, you have to give truma to the Kohen or Meiser. You don't make a whole fanfare. You give it to them. Here they had a whole parade. Everybody got together in their city, and they slept in the outside, and they had musicians, and they marched and converged on Yerushalayim from all the cities together in a big parade. Why? So I saw somebody says, because it's possible that the first fruit will be a little scrawny little nothing. You got to go all schlep all the way to Yerushalayim for that little thing, and that's what I'm happy about. Oh, wow, I have this great, what's it called, date, right, fig. Well, it's about that big or whatever, and I'm bringing it to the Shalayim. Right? Okay, I'll take a tenth of my crop, or truma, a 50th, a 40th, but one little measly fig for that will make it a big deal? Yes. Recognize the fact that you don't deserve anything. If you have one little scrawny little fig, be happy about it. Make a big deal about it. That's the second part of Hakaras HaTov. Recognize there's good. It's not coming to you. And therefore recognize every little good that there is and make a big deal about it. And lastly, we learn this from Bikurim too, once you recognize that there's good and you, acknowledge every little good, then if you want to come to belief in God from recognizing good, attribute it to God. Meaning the following. Most of us look at secondary causes and attribute our successes or whatever to them. And we thank them or whatever. For instance, give an example with a little baby. A little baby drinks milk from a bottle. So every day, right, in his mind, he thanks the bottle for giving him milk. Right? Milk is really great, and the bottle gives me that milk, and I really thank the bottle. He gets a little bit older, and he sees that his mother pours the milk into the bottle from a container. Oh, man, I've been making this terrible mistake. I thought bottles give milk. Containers give milk. So from now on, his daily thank you goes to the container. Thank you, container, for giving me milk. Then he sees, one day, he goes shopping with his mother, and he sees that she buys the container in a supermarket. Oh, man, I thought containers give milk. It's supermarkets that give milk. So he thanks the owner of the supermarket for the milk in his mind. Okay. Then they take him out to a farm, and he sees the cows give milk. Oh, man, thank you, cow. Then he sees the cows eat grass, and the milk comes from the grass. Thank you, grass. Until, if you trace everything back to its first cause, you come back to the Ribbono Shel Olam. God set all of this into motion. So if you trace things back to their source, you come back to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's part of Hakaras HaTov. That's why it says, whoever says Tehillah LeDavid, which we call Ashrei, three times a day, is Muftach Lo Shu Ben Olam Habo. What does Ashrei teach me? It has the Aleph phase, and it has the Pasuk, Poseach Es Yodecha U'Masbia L'Chol Chai Ratzon. God opens his hand and provides sustenance to everything. Why both of these things? Because first you have to recognize the fact that God provides sustenance to everything. Everything what it needs. But how do you know that God does it? Maybe the cow does it. Maybe the grass does it. Maybe the supermarket does it. Maybe the bottle does it. Because you have to trace things back to the source. So it has the Aleph phase. There's an orderly progression. And if you trace things back from the top, you'll come to the Aleph. You'll come back mathematically, progression-wise, back to the source of everything. So Poseach es Yodecha and the Aleph base together will bring you to a recognition of God. You'll be a Ben Olam Haba. That's Bikurim also. Bikurim is to recognize the smallest good. You have this little scrawny fig. Make a big deal about it. Recognize the fact that God gave you that. It wasn't coming to you. You planted it. You fertilized it. Fine. Did you make the rain? Did you make all the conditions? You could have all the right hishtadlus, but if there's a hurricane, there's a flood, there's an earthquake, you're not going to have that scrawny fig. So recognize the fact that God is the one who, what's it called, it's not coming to you. Recognize the fact that you got some benefit that you may have not gotten. And even if it's a small benefit, make a big deal about it. And then trace it back to its source. That's why when we bring Bikurim, we go through a whole course in Jewish history. Where did Lavan want to destroy Yaakov, and then he went to Mitzrayim, and then we were enslaved, and then God took us out, and he brought us this land? Why all this Jewish history for a scrawny little fig? Now the answer is, once I recognize the good, and I even recognize it in the smallest thing and make a big deal about it, now trace it back to the source. Where does it come from? It must have come from somewhere. So you can attribute it your prowess in planting, or you can attribute to the ground, but if you go back enough, you'll attribute to the first cause, which is God. So you need to trace it back to its source. That's when we bring Bikurim, we trace the Jewish people and this fruit back to its source. All three things together, that is Hakara Satov, which by recognizing good in the world, you'll come to recognize the source of all good, which is the Ribbono Shel Olam. And therefore, Amalek, if you want to know what brings people to deny God and to ignore him and to be as evil as Amalek, it starts with not recognizing good in the world. If you're ungrateful and you don't recognize good, then you won't recognize God. And you'll forget about God completely, and you'll end up being an Amalek. That's the consequences of the absence of Hakaras HaTov. So that's also one of the hallmarks of the mitzvah Bikurim, the mitzvah of Hakaras HaTov, and that also partly preparing for Rosh Hashanah is to appreciate life. I don't have maybe the iPod I wanted, but I have life. Who guaranteed that I have life? So be happy with what you have, the good of the basics, and trace it back to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that way you'll have a greater bond and a greater connection to the Ribbono Shel Olam based on your recognition of good, your feeling grateful for it, and your tracing it to the Ribbono Shel Olam.